Greetings, and welcome to Research on Religion, a weekly podcast series devoted to the social scientific study of religion. I'm Anthony Gill, your host, professor of political science at the University of Washington, and distinguished senior fellow at Baylor University's Institute for Studies of Religion, the gracious sponsor of our podcast. We encourage you to visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org to post comments, ask questions, access additional material related to today's program, and to find out what is happening at the Institute. All right, let's begin. My guest today is Professor Christopher Sober, a distinguished professor of political science at Pepperdine University. Dr. Sober received his PhD and a Master's of Divinity from Yale University and a Bachelor's of Arts degree from the University of Washington. Go Dogs! Specializing in the field of religion and politics in Western democracies, he is the author of a number of books, including Confucianism and Democracy in Taiwan, co-authored with Joel Fetzer, who we interviewed earlier on that topic, Muslims and the State in Britain, France, and Germany, also with Joel Fetzer, Faith, Hope, and Jobs, Welfare to Work in Los Angeles with the late Stephen Monsma, and The Challenge of Pluralism, Church and State in Six Democracies, which just came out in its third edition, which is quite an accomplishment. That book was co-authored with Stephen Monsma and Kevin Dendulk over at Calvin. Chris was the recipient of the Howard A. White Teaching Award at Pepperdine back in 2005 and is an avid Mariners baseball fan, one of the few remaining on the West Coast. Folks, don't forget that we are on iTunes, and we hope to soon be on SoundCloud and Stitcher as well. So please be looking forward to announcements on that. And come to our website and say hi. Check out all the different links that we have to Chris Sober's books, as well as a number of other interesting things as well. Chris, welcome to Research on Religion.
Thank you very much. It's great to be here.
Hey, how about that University of Washington Husky football team going to the Final Four National Championship?
Well, that was very exciting. As you noted, I did my undergraduate there, and I have remained quite loyal to the Dogs, although I have to admit, much to my chagrin, my daughter went to USC, and so we have divided football loyalties in our household.
Well, show your loyalty. Give a woof, woof, woof out there for the Huskies.
Woof, woof, woof.
There you go. See? You don't get many guests doing that. Well, we're not here to bark very much. We're here to actually talk about the third edition of your new book. As I noted in our introduction, The Challenge of Pluralism is in its third edition. Count them, three. One, two, three. And that was initially published in 1997 and has been updated twice for events over the past two decades. And for those of you who don't know this, that is a huge accomplishment in academia, as most books that are written by academics usually fade into oblivion after a year or two. So to have a third edition is a good deal. I should also note that one of the folks who wrote a book blurb on the back of the book said, when it was first published, The Challenge of Pluralism was one of the earliest and most detailed explorations of how Europe is dealing with its changing religious landscape amidst a history of state churches and secularization. With the increasing cultural presence of Islam being felt across the continent, this updated study of Europe's regulation of religion remains all the more relevant and important. Do you know who said that, Chris?
I do indeed. Yes, thank you for those kind words.
That was me. Yeah. Yes, I said that, and congratulations on the third edition of this book. I've used it in classes before, and it's a great feeling to go third edition.
Yeah, well, again, I thank you for your kind words. I hope that you have found that it's relatively teachable, at least, you know, each chapter being a different country. When I've taught it, I think that makes it sort of manageable for students. And as I'm sure you agree, there's a lot of value in introducing American students to how other countries handle these kinds of issues.
Yeah, and it's all the more prescient, too, because, again, we noted it was first published in 1997, and it's almost as if you anticipated a number of the problems that Europe has faced over the last 20 years or so. So really good. I also should note that one of your co-authors, when you first wrote the book, it was with Stephen Monsma, and he recently passed away. I was wondering if you had some reflections upon his career that you wanted to share.
Well, for those of the people listening who didn't know him, Steve was an outstanding scholar, but a better person and a better Christian. He was, for me and many others, a model of academic and personal integrity. For better or worse, he was one of the founders of the Religion and Politics section of the American Political Science Association. And he was really one of the first political scientists to look seriously at the role of religion in public life. I think it's hard for us to imagine now, but there was a time that religion was a backwater topic at best in most of the social sciences. And Steve and a few others brought the topic of religion back to our discipline. And then I guess the last thing I'd say about Steve was that he had very strong normative convictions, but he was also deeply committed to the highest degree of academic quality. He didn't stretch the truth. He didn't manipulate the data. He didn't evade wherever his arguments were leading. And in that sense, I think he frustrated the ideologues of the left and the right, but it earned him a lot of well-deserved respect. He was, in short, his work was always first-rate, even as it was informed deeply by his own personal faith.
And a fantastic work in this book, Challenge of Pluralism, and the earlier work you did with him on the work to welfare programs or welfare to work programs in Los Angeles as well. What brought you two together to write this book on religious pluralism in Europe back in the 1990s?
There were a couple of things. Years ago, I found myself, believe it or not, reading the book review section of the American Political Science Review. And I don't even remember now what the book was, but it had something to do with church and state. And I remember that the writer of the review alluded to the idea that church-state separation was a uniform concept among political democracies. And that just seemed wrong to me. So I went to Steve and said, we really should do a comparative book. Now, at that point, in all honesty, I didn't know much about countries other than the U.S. and England, but Steve was pretty well-versed on Germany and the Netherlands. And so we decided to do the book. And then I think the other reason would be that, you know, I had found in my own graduate work that the best way to learn about the political experiences of one country was to compare it with the political experiences of another country. I think both Steve and I felt that doing a comparative book would be, hopefully, informative for a largely American audience.
It certainly was, too. You have Netherlands, Germany, England in there, and I think the initial version of this book, you had France, and then you added Australia in the second edition. Is that correct?
Not quite. So Australia was in the first edition. The France has only been added in this third edition. So it was the five countries, England, UK, US, Netherlands, and Germany for the first two, and then France has been added for this third edition.
Yeah, it shows you how close I've been reading it. My memory is a little bit fuzzy there. I think I'm thinking of your other book with Joel Fetzer, where France was in there. So,
right.
What motivated the third edition, and what also motivated you to put in France and also bring Kevin Dendulk in on the project?
So, really several things. Certainly, in the first two editions, we had addressed the issue of Islam, but the treatment was brief and, frankly, a bit tentative. But obviously, there have been a lot of political changes on the ground in each of these countries on the issue of Islam, so it seemed important to cover the topic more systematically. Steve and I had been wanting to add France in the second edition, but just never got around to doing it, frankly. And this also answers your question about bringing Kevin along. Kevin had done some research on France, and so we approached him about taking the lead on the France chapter. We thought it would make a nice comparison with the U.S. because they both have a system of church-state separation, but the history behind those models is really quite different. And so we thought that adding France would be a nice way. We'd have six countries, and we would have three different models and two countries in each model representing a slightly different variation of that model.
And it works out very well. Even numbers always work out very well. So you have three different models. We're going to talk about the models here in a second, but you begin your book with three basic questions relating to the role of church and state in democratic and religiously pluralistic societies. What are these three questions?
So the first question is, I guess, you know, from an American standpoint, it was sort of the religious freedom question, or, you know, free exercise question, which is how far can a political democracy go in allowing religiously motivated behavior that is perceived as contrary to social welfare norms? So how generous is the state going to be in allowing religious freedom, and particularly in some of those hard cases where the practice of a particular religious tradition is somehow seen as contrary to the general norms of society.
Give us an example of that, maybe, if you could.
So it could be something like in France, the decision to ban the wearing of the hijab. There is a French norm about the public space being free of any kind of religious symbol. Yet that runs up against the mandate that some Muslims feel to be veiled. So you have a kind of tension between what a social norm is and the demands of religious freedom. Or in the United States, say the issue of conscientious objection from war. So there might be a draft that certainly throughout much of American history, when there were drafts, there wasn't an allowance for conscientious objection. So where do you draw the line when policies demand one thing and religious freedom demands something else?
Okay. What are the other questions that you're addressing?
Okay, so the second question is, I mean, the way we state it in the book is this way: should the state encourage and promote consensual religious beliefs and traditions in an attempt to support the common values and virtues that bind society together? The idea behind this is that every political system has some shared value that it seeks to promote. The question is, can religion or religious values be the basis for those shared social values? So again, assuming that some social norms, shared social norms, are necessary, to what extent, if any, can they be religious? And then the third question is what, in the American context, I guess we would call the kind of religious establishment question, which is, when religious groups and the government are both involved in the same fields of endeavor, such as education, how can we be ensured that the state doesn't advantage or disadvantage one religious group or religion over secular belief systems over another? So, again, it's sort of an equal treatment question. How can we be, when the state is providing some public good, and religion is also involved in providing that public good, what does equal treatment demand?
One of the things that you argue in posing that question is that secularism can be considered a religion as well, or at least competing with religion, and that there's this tension. Oftentimes we just think, well, there's religion, and then, you know, that secular thing is something different. That's the default option. So make the case there.
Yeah, so whether you define secularism as a religion, I'm not sure I would use that term, but I would certainly say that it's a belief system.
Right.
And that, as you sort of alluded to, there's sometimes the assumption that secularism is neutral vis-a-vis ways of living or vis-a-vis value systems. But we argue it isn't, that it's making certain normative claims. And so, if you accept that premise, then you look at issues of state policy differently, meaning you don't look, as you sort of said, at secularism as a default neutral position, you look at a secular policy option as an option among many options. And then you can imagine that a secular choice is competing with alternative worldviews, religious and otherwise, in terms of state policy.
Now, there's got to be a difficult balancing act here, especially in relation to the third question that you pose and slingshotting it back to the second question of whether you can promote shared values here. Because the question becomes, well, what shared values and what happens if the society changes over time? It becomes more secular. Should you still be promoting Catholicism? Or if new immigrants come in with a different religion, should you be promoting that? So what role does the state really have in juggling this difficult, I guess, balancing act?
Well, as far as that second question, we come to the conclusion that in religiously pluralistic cultures, which all of these are, and much of the world increasingly is, the state really can't promote that there are not consensual religious values anymore. And so while there may be shared social norms, and shared social norms that are important for political stability, maybe tolerance or pluralism or, you know, belief in limited democratic forms of government, the government cannot really any longer, to the extent that it ever could, promote a particular religious set of values. There's a naivete about that there is some overlapping consensus among various religious traditions that would somehow allow the state to promote some sort of shared religious norm. So in the end, we argue states have to give up on that enterprise. That which isn't to say that we don't think religious groups have a robust role to play. It's just that the state can't make choices among diverging religious positions when they're promoting some sort of shared social norm.
Yeah, so in doing this, you take six countries and you lay out, as you said, three different models here. The categories of these are strict church-state separation, which fall U.S. and France. You have the established church model, which would be England and Germany, and then the structuralist pluralist model of the Netherlands and Australia. So give us a quick lowdown on what each of these models were and how you more or less came to settle on these.
Okay, so let me make a few general comments before I talk about the specific models. I think what we discover in the book is that the model embraced by each of the countries informs the politics of church-state relations in that country. So separation, accommodation, establishment forms what we argue are mindsets about how best to adjudicate church-state issues. That mindset, in turn, impacts the policy choices adopted and also the politics around issues like education or social welfare provision. So not to get too political sciencey here, but the models provide a kind of path dependency or a kind of policy stickiness. So they shape the terms of the debate in these different countries. So what we argue is that you can categorize these countries into one of these three models, and France and the United States are similar insofar as they share a separationist mindset or an ideological construct that defines neutrality between religion and the state as being one where they are seen as wholly separate from each other as much as possible. So that model presumes that religion is principally a private affair that can and should be kept from the public square. Now, we note that there are significant differences between the U.S. and France about how they came to adopt their policies, but the basic tension in each will be in how they understand and apply the separationist model to specific issues that they address. So then the second model would be that, to take the other extreme, would be the establishment model. And again, it's important to note that we're talking about a continuum here, so they run the gamut from a country like Saudi Arabia, where the links between Islam and the state are pervasive, and a country like England where they're not nearly so deep. Nonetheless, we argue that England and Germany fit the model insofar as the state and a church, or churches in Germany, form a formal partnership in advancing the cause of religion in the state. So the state provides the church with recognition, often financial support. The church provides the state with legitimacy and some sense of national purpose and unity. And then finally, the third model would be the pluralist model, where we have the Netherlands and Australia. Again, they presume a different relationship with a different understanding about what political neutrality demands. So for these countries, religion has a public function, and the obligation of the state is to ensure that religious groups can live out their faith in and through public institutions like the school. So in these states, separation is seen as disadvantaging religious groups. Neutrality is maintained by an equal treatment of all religious groups, rather than the state preferring one over another, as in England or Germany, or preferring no religion to religion, which is sometimes the mistake in separationist models. Moreover, we would argue that the pluralist model has a robust appreciation for religious freedom. It understands that faith has a public dimension to it that the state has to recognize and accommodate.
I should note that in your book, you actually have the strict separationist category first in the order of chapters, then you go to the pluralist, and then to the establishment. I'm reversing that a little bit because I want to look at the two polar ends of the spectrum, if we could think about it that way, and then talk about that middle category, because I think you make a very interesting and defensible case for how societies perhaps could organize this balancing act, or deal with this balancing act between different types of religion and secularism. So let's go ahead and start with the strict separationist model first, as I think most of our listeners would probably be most familiar with the U.S. model, although we do have many listeners in Australia, as I found out, so bully for us there. Explain why the U.S. and then also France are both in the separationist model, how they might differ, and what socio-political tensions have arisen with these church-state arrangements. Go ahead and start with the U.S.
I guess if I had to categorize them, I would say that they're both separationist in that the default position is to remove religion from political life as much as possible. Now, there are certainly differences between them and important historical differences in how the countries came to adopt those models. So, you know, we argue that in the U.S. it was kind of a happy separationist that came about. It wasn't a separation that was understood as some kind of an attack on religion, but it was understood as a way to allow religion to flourish. Whereas historically in France, separation is more a model adopted in opposition to religion as a way of kind of putting religion in its place. And so I think even today, what one can see is that in both countries, you see opposing poles, a more aggressive form of separation, which manifests itself in a country like France with something like the hijab ban. But also in the United States, where you can see certain court cases where there is a mindset about religion that its appropriate role is in the private sphere. Or certain political rhetoric you'll get around issues like religious symbols in government buildings. At the same time, the other end of the pole in both countries is a more benign form of separation, where the state is more willing to accommodate religion, even as separation is maintained as a model. I think in both countries, challenges to that come from genuine religious pluralism in the case of France, and new forms of religious pluralism in the case of the United States, where the practices of a particular religious group have a public manifestation to it that some people are not comfortable with. So, again, obviously in France, it would be about how far should the state go to allow public religiosity for Muslims? And in the United States, it's always been around religious newcomers or new religious movements who have some public, there's some public role for their religion that runs up against state policy.
Give us an example of how each of these states are wrangling with one particular issue in light of this model and how that model is really being tested by contemporary challenges.
Well, I think in the United States would be an issue such as religious social welfare organizations. What kind of autonomy do they have in hiring practices? So they're in receipt of certain forms of government aid, you know, say homeless shelter. So two sets of questions would emerge. One, you know, can they offer religious services as a part of their program? Can they have prayers at the beginning of meals? Can they have Bible studies as a part of the programs that they offer? To what extent are they allowed, are they given, are they allowed to hire for mission? So if they have a strong missional feel that a particular person needs to be supportive of the religious tradition from which the group comes, are they allowed to do that? And again, in France, I think it seems consistently to be around the issue of Muslims. So whether it's the hijab ban or a burqa ban, it's about how far can the state go to restrict the public expression of religion in France.
In terms of France, how is some of our listeners might not know exactly what's going on with this hijab ban and stuff. What has been the dimensions on which this tension with Islam has originated over the past, two decades or so?
Well, again, and here I think this is where, the United States is, maybe the United States and Australia are distinctive in these countries in that the U.S. and Australia have more of a history of contending with religious pluralism. So France, ever since the Edict of Nantes, I guess, has not had as much religious pluralism. And so starting several decades ago, you had the immigration of large numbers of Muslim workers who ended up settling in France and other Western European countries, and they have grown as a percentage of the population. So they are now somewhere between 7 and 10% of the French population, although much larger percentage in certain urban centers. So you had a country that was accustomed to dealing with the Roman Catholic Church in good ways and bad, but not really contending with much genuine religious pluralism. There were only a handful of Protestants in France and even a smaller number of Jews. So now you have a new religious tradition whose practices are very different from the cultural norm. And you have a state policy that can be perceived as disadvantaging religious groups who want the public manifestation of their religion. So they want to be able to, some Muslims want to be able to wear the hijab, or they want to be able to build mosques, and which is often a difficult proposition because of regulatory laws. They want policies around halal meat in public institutions. So part of the issue, I think, in France is just an absence of a tradition of dealing with that kind of religious pluralism. And here again, I would say, the United States shares a similar model, but a different history, a greater history of religious pluralism. And while not always perfect in the United States, I think a capacity to handle those kinds of issues more successfully than has been the case in a country like France.
Is part of the reason, too, that some of the newer religious traditions that make it to the United States usually include members from very high-end socioeconomic classes, where, you know, it's a big journey to get to the United States as compared from Algeria to France. Is there a socioeconomic dimension to this as well?
I think there has to be. I think you're absolutely right about, if you look at the demographics of, say, for example, the American Muslim community compared to the British, the German, the French, it's much higher socioeconomically. And we would predict that those groups would accommodate themselves more successfully over time. But I also think that, you know, this is a little further afield from the book's topic, but I also think that, again, here's a case where the United States has more of a history of immigration and a kind of a positive immigration narrative that is largely absent in a lot of European countries. And then added to that of the burden that, in the case of a country like France, the large percentage of Muslim immigrants are from a former colony, Algeria or Morocco. So the travel to France isn't as always the historical memory of these immigrants isn't always positive. Algeria is deeply problematic in French history because of its colonial past. So I think there are myriad, multiple factors that explain the difficulties in a country like France. I think their church-state history is one of them, but as you allude to, there are others as well.
Now, in terms of the changing structure, this changing socioeconomic and demographic structure of these countries, are these models of strict separationist becoming problematic? What future do you see for them? Do you see greater degrees of conflict, any kind of change in their policies down the line?
You know, I think one thing we argue in the book is, as I sort of alluded to earlier, the idea of policy stickiness, the idea that countries that adopt models, in some cases centuries ago, don't change them overnight. I don't anticipate any of these countries, despite the challenges that each of them faces, moving out of their one model and into another. It gets deeply embedded in the psyche and in the institutional structure of these countries, which doesn't mean to say they won't face challenges. They clearly will face challenges. And for each of the countries, with the possible exception of the United States, one of the biggest challenges is Islamic immigration, and not even immigration so much anymore, but just the growth of the Islamic population that are citizens and have been born in those countries, and who tend to be much more religiously practicing than other people in the country. So not only do you have a divergence between a largely Christian population and a Muslim population, but you have a divergence between a Muslim population that is more religiously active and a Christian population that's increasingly secular in orientation. So you sort of have tensions along both of those dimensions.
Well, something to be looking forward in the future. And for scholars or graduate students who are interested in this topic, this is a great framework to operate from. The book The Challenge of Pluralism really sets up these models nicely as a way for you to springboard into a lot of other questions. Speaking of springboarding, let's go ahead and move to the next set of countries, which represents the establishment model, and that would be England and Germany. So tell us a little bit about the establishment model and what's going on in each of these countries where the model leads to certain policies and to certain political outcomes.
Well, for those of your listeners who watched The Crown this past year, you probably learned that England has a formally established church, the Church of England. So there are certain formal connections and certain formal roles the Church of England plays. Germany's establishment model isn't it's not identified with a particular religious tradition, but what we argue is that there are three historically recognized churches, what they call Evangelische, which is Lutheran essentially, Catholic and Jewish communities. So here are countries where there are formal links between either a church, the Church of England, or churches and the state. And as I alluded to earlier, there's a mindset that these churches have a formal social role to play. Not only a kind of legitimating role, but it can take an institutional form in something like religious schools, which in all of these, and certainly in England, there's a long history of religious schools. I should also note that England's establishment has become softer in the past several decades, so virtually all of the disadvantages that used to apply if you were not a member of the Church of England no longer apply. And most of the benefits that go to the Church of England are now available to other churches as well, except at certain marginal issues. So again, I think it's about formal linkages between churches and the state, formal roles in certain public functions or in social welfare provision or education provision.
Now, a question about the English establishment, as well with the German establishment. How much government funding does the state provide to these religious institutions?
You know, you might be surprised. In England, it's very, very little. There are certain funding schemes that they can get for their buildings, the historic buildings, but the churches are primarily responsible for raising their own funding to, say, pay for priests. But again, there's a whole system of religious schools where they get most of their funding from the government. Germany is even more complex from an American standpoint. There's something in Germany called the church tax. So, you know, again, it's partly a function of that they have a very different history than we do. And the large religious communities, i.e. the Catholics and the Lutherans, the assumption was that you were born into a religious community and that you get registered with that religious community at birth. And if you are registered with those religious communities, which virtually all Germans are, you are then taxed a certain amount annually to support the work of the churches. Now, you can opt out of that, but it's a fairly laborious process to opt out of it. So the default position is that you're in it. So you pay a special tax. Now, the tax is, again, by American ears, this just seems so strange. The tax is collected by the government and then sent out to the churches, So in that sense, the pastors, the priests of churches in Germany are a little closer to being kind of government employees. So the fund and the funding for churches comes through that church tax. The funding for, I mean, the two largest nonprofit social welfare organizations are a Catholic organization and an Evangelische one. Those get all of their funding from the government through this church tax. So, and if you talk to Germans, it's kind of amazing that there's very little, they don't have high rates of church attendance, but there's also not much public opposition to the church tax. So they view it as kind of a support for the social role that churches play.
So it's interesting with the church tax that the government actually collects these things, redistributes it back to the Catholic Church, to the Lutheran Church, and that would seem pretty easy if there's a religious hierarchy. You know, you had a archbishop to give it to, or, you know, the head of the Lutheran Church is pretty easy. I can imagine this a little bit more difficult in terms of more decentralized religions like Judaism. How's that spread there? And also Islam, which is a growing presence in Germany.
Well, that's an interesting question. And, you know, one thing that's interesting to note is the degree to which, when you have a model like that, does it lead religious traditions to adopt forms that are necessary in order to get that funding? Mm-hmm. So the quick answer to your question for the Jewish community is that they've created a kind of a hierarchical organization to, in order to become a part of the church tax system. Now, it's a huge issue with Muslims. They are, incredibly internally divided, and if you talk to German officials, their argument, then they have not been included in the church tax system. And I should note, further complicating things is that some of these decisions are taken at the state level, so there's some diversity among the German states. German officials will often say that, well, the problem is that Muslims aren't organized hierarchically. We don't know who to negotiate with. And there's some truth to that. You know, the system was created with imagining that hierarchical models were just the norm, but they are quickly discovering that isn't the case. It's also not the case, of course, for Protestant churches. But there are certain German states that have gone the extra mile and tried to work with Protestant churches who want to be a part of the system in order to find some way to include them. And I think it's inevitable that the same will happen with German Muslims.
Yeah, I can imagine how there's a certain disincentive that if everybody's paying a church tax that you're born into and it's somewhat cumbersome to get out of it. I've actually had some German graduate students who said, yeah, I don't want to pay this. And then when they try paying it, they get a visit, and, you know, there's a cooling off period. Say, yep. Do you really want to opt out of this? And they say, well, you know, it's just not worth it in case I want to get married. But if you're a Protestant missionary group, a Pentecostal group, Jehovah Witnesses, whatever it may be, you coming in there, it's got to be pretty difficult to recruit people, because you go knock on the door, you meet them in the public square, and you say, hey, join our church, and, oh, by the way, you got a tithe, and you're like, well, I'm already paying this church tax, so I don't have to do it twice. Do you think that there is a disincentive to proselytization in those type of countries?
Well, first of all, there are a lot of churches, Protestant churches, that for theological reasons do not want to be a part of the church tax system.
Right.
And argue that it is bad for churches to be engaged in that. So you're not required, obviously, to be a part of it. I guess what I would hope would be that the state would make it easier to opt out, so people want to opt out of the system. And if you look, and I guess I would also say that it isn't a lid for these other movements, insofar as the churches that are growing in Germany are the ones that are often outside the system. So maybe they'd grow even more if people also had some sort of financial, if there weren't the financial disincentive. But, you know, the evangelical churches that are growing in Germany are by and large not a part of the church tax system, and it doesn't seem to be stopping them from recruiting people.
Interesting. So what kind of challenges does increasing pluralism, and specifically Islam, play in England and in Germany, and how is the state adjusting to all of this?
Well, sort of as we've been hinting at, you know, the big challenge with an establishment model is that there are certain ways where a church or some small number of churches are advantaged. So how do you defend that in light of increased religious pluralism? So the book sort of walks through how these countries historically adopted them, and the models made a lot of sense in a culture that was more religiously monopolized. But what do you do in the face of genuine religious pluralism? Now, what I will say is that in the case of Muslims, and of course in both of these countries, Muslims are not fully have not been fully accommodated into the existing system. But what I will say is that British Muslims, German Muslims, are not generally arguing in favor of a kind of American-style separationist model. So what they like about the establishment is the kind of cultural assumptions it has about a public role for religion. What they want, of course, is to be accorded the same benefits that the established churches get. So an issue in England is something like in the House of Lords, which is largely a ceremonial institution, has some political power. There are a certain number of seats that automatically go to bishops in the Church of England, 24 seats. And there's no automatic membership for clergy or religious leaders in any other tradition. So if you talk to people who are Muslim, what they'll say is, we like the fact that there is this institution where a religious voice gets to be heard, formally heard. We just think it should be expanded to reflect the pluralism of England. We're not arguing that the House of Lords should abandon those seats for spiritual leaders.
And how about Germany?
Again, I think it's the big issue in Germany is, well, I'd say there's two issues in Germany. For a variety of reasons, Germany actually has very few religious schools. And one of the reasons for that is that Germany, wow, more than just about any country in our study, maybe more, like England, allows quite a bit of religious education in the school. So then, of course, the question becomes, how are you going to include a treatment of Islam in schools? And I would say, by and large, the states that control education are gradually coming around and are treating Islam the same way that they are treating Christian traditions. And then the second issue in Germany is the one we talked about earlier, which is public corporation status. And so far, there have been efforts to grant it, but it's been a difficult process.
Let us finish up here with the third model, talking about this middle ground, which is the pluralist model. And here we include the Netherlands and Australia. And you break the pluralism model down into two separate categories or subcategories, principled pluralism, which would be the Netherlands, and pragmatic pluralism, which would be the Aussies. Tell us about this.
So what we argue is that they both have a form of pluralism in their church-state relations, but how they got there is different. So what we contend is that the Netherlands gets their model through a principled commitment to public accommodation of religious voices. So there were key religious leaders who were playing a political role who advocated the argument that political society is better engaged when multiple voices, religious and non-religious, are part of the process. So we argue their pluralism comes out of kind of principled commitment to pluralism itself. In the case of Australia, we argue it's more a pragmatic pluralism, meaning it is a response to political realities on the ground, meaning before it was a federation, the Australian colonies, and then when it becomes a federation, the Australian state is religiously pluralistic. There's not necessarily a deep philosophical commitment to pluralism, but the model they adopt is a pragmatic reaction to the kind of religious pluralism in their midst. So they come to the same policy choices in the Netherlands, but they get there through different historical processes.
Can I just ask a little bit about Australian pluralism? Because that might surprise a number of our listeners, and myself as well. I don't know very much about Australia, but it just seems that, they're an English colony, so probably just Church of England and maybe
yeah.
Foster's Lager. Is there what kind of pluralism occurs there?
Well, and you're right that it was an English colony, of course, a penal colony, as the Australians are very proud to say. And what you see historically is that originally the English did try to sort of impose that model on the Australian colony. But what we argue is that they weren't all that deeply committed to it by that point. So you're talking about the middle of the 19th century. Even in England, political support for the establishment was starting to wane. And you also, of course, had a convict population that was overwhelmingly Roman Catholic. One can imagine that Roman Catholic convicts are not particularly, many of whom were from Ireland, were not particularly happy to be having Anglicanism shoved down their throats. So the key states in Australia, the key colonies, abandon the establishment model because they wanted religion to play a robust political role in shaping moral lives. And they quickly came to recognize that multiple religious groups could do that. And so that established early on in certain colonies a model that would later be adopted at the federal level. And Australia is also interesting because they draft their constitution and they use virtually the same language as the American famous language in the First Amendment about religious free exercise and establishment of religion. But they've interpreted those words differently, particularly as far as the establishment is concerned. So there is a robust system of public money going to a wide variety of religious schools in Australia. So the brief answer to your question I've gone on is they did initially sort of impose an establishment model, but in this way, not unlike the United States, religious pluralism on the ground made it hard to maintain that model over time, and the reasons for maintaining it seemed nonsensical to the people who were trying to govern this new territory.
Yeah, so that kind of just leaves it the pragmatic pluralism option, where they go, yeah, well, just whatever, everybody get along, and we'll just help you get along.
Right.
Yeah. The more interesting case is the Netherlands. And the Netherlands, as I read your book, too, is one of the cases that I think you hold up in the highest esteem. They've been best able to juggle a lot of the pluralistic nature of the religious landscape that they have. Explain what the Dutch do and how they do it so well.
Well, I think that the part of the Dutch model that we are particularly sympathetic toward is that they understand religious freedom, that for many groups, religious freedom has a public dimension to it. So, and in recognizing that, the state has been willing to accommodate religious groups in public places. So, most notably in something like education. So, you know, rather than in the United States, which perceives a public school system devoid of any overt ideological perspective, in the United States that's viewed as neutral. In Australia, the Netherlands, that is viewed as an ideological perspective. It's a secular perspective. It's a perfectly legitimate perspective, but it is a perspective. But they would argue that true neutrality then is won if you are even-handed among different perspectives. So they take steps to allow religious groups to form organizations to live out their life through public institutions. So I think that's probably, and so in our view, that is a kind of a positive understanding of religious freedom that is sometimes absent from the American debate.
Yeah, one of the things that they do there, they have a special term for it called pillarization. What does that mean? And it obviously it plays out in schools, but are there any other dimensions in social, economic, and political life where it plays out as well?
So this was a model that was adopted in the 20th century, and it still exists, although it has weakened some, it's also expanded some. So when it was originally created, the idea was that there were three kind of ideological perspectives in which one could live one's life. A kind of Catholic pillar, a Reformed Protestant pillar, and a secular pillar. And in its earliest form, that meant the creation of a whole series of institutions, not just the school, but political parties that would reflect that perspective, even sports associations, newspapers, and even universities. So even to this day in the Netherlands, although I don't think people think about it that much anymore, universities are often historically associated with Reformed Protestantism, with Catholicism, or with secularism. So in its earliest form, a citizen could attach herself to the ideological perspective with which she was most comfortable in a series of institutions. Now, it's not nearly so hard and fast now as it was, say, 50 years ago, but it still exists. There are still institutions you can see it manifest. And the other thing that's changed is I think there's greater diversity in those pillars. So I think there's a de facto Islamic pillar now, meaning that they do finance Islamic schools. There's more diversity within the Reformed pillar. So not unlike American Protestantism, there are, for lack of, you know, to gross generalization, more liberal versions of it and more conservative versions of it. So the model has changed over time, and I think people's attachments have loosened, but it still exists.
You mentioned that there's now a de facto Muslim pillar that is in existence. How well has the Netherlands been in adapting to or accommodating Islam relative to some of its neighbors?
So as is true with a lot of these questions, it's a deeply controversial question. And I would say there's two ways of looking at it. I think the Netherlands has done an exceptionally good job of recognizing and accommodating Dutch Muslims. The harder question is, do any of these different models do a better or worse job to ensure the successful accommodation and incorporation of European Muslims into their particular respective culture? So there certainly are critics of the Dutch model who would argue that this kind of pillarization simply allows a kind of ghettoization for Dutch Muslims, that they don't engage in, that they're less likely to engage in pluralistic institutions, and therefore they're going to be less successful at accommodating themselves to life in the Netherlands. You know, I think we would push back on that and say that there's not a lot of evidence that when people participate in these kinds of pillars, that they are necessarily less a part of Dutch society. But I think that's where you would get some of the hard questions and the controversial ones. And so obviously the defenders of the French system say, we don't allow these kind of pillars. We have these public institutions that are open to all and that are going to train people in shared French political values that ensure their successful incorporation into France. Now, if you look at France, of course, it's hard to sustain the argument that the French have somehow done a better job at incorporating their Muslim population than the Netherlands. So it's not clear to me that the arguments against the Dutch model are proved by the French model, which uses a very different system.
Well, things to definitely be watching out for. And again, this book is interesting for its individual case studies, but it's always a great way to reflect upon one's own country and to think about, okay, how do other places do this? What could we do different? What is our future relative to what other countries look like? And I want to throw in a little bit of a controversial question, a little bit tangential to your book. A few weeks back, we had a debate with a number of scholars on whether the United States, which in your book and many other people have argued, tends to give preferential status to secularism or a secular mindset in public schools and other public square institutions. Some have made the case that, you know, what we need is a Christian Democratic Party, just like they have in Europe, and that this might help even the playing field a little bit more. Have you given any kind of thought to that kind of thing? And how would you respond to the presence of a Christian Democratic Party here in the United States?
Well, let me preface it by noting that this is a question where Steve and I parted company. Mm-hmm. Very close friend of mine, mentor, but we didn't agree on everything. So Steve was deeply committed to reform theology, and he would have advocated the idea that God's sovereignty should be made to prevail in all institutions, including political ones. So I think he would have likely have been more sympathetic to a Christian Democratic Party in the United States along the lines of those in Europe. I guess I'm much more Anabaptist in orientation, and so I take a dim view of the capacity of a political party or political institutions in promoting Christian values, let alone bringing about the kingdom of God. So, and at a more practical level, I doubt very much that a Christian Democratic Party could be successfully formed in the United States. I'm sure your panel talked about various institutional mechanisms that prohibit third parties here. Nor am I convinced that there's a market for a Christian party, at least as I would understand it, because there's tremendous diversity of viewpoints among American Christians. But I guess for me, I'd return to the theological point, which is I think there are multiple dangers in Christians identifying ourselves with the realpolitik of the political world. I hope I won't offend too many of your listeners when I argue that I think American Christians have done significant damage in aligning ourselves with Donald Trump and the Republican Party. And so for me, a far better strategy would be to create what Stanley Hauerwas, theologian, described as communities of character, where Christians are living out our faith in ways that are models for the people around us. It doesn't mean that we are disengaged from the political world, in part because if we create those communities, I think we're making political statements each and every day. It just means that we don't look to political institutions to shape us into the kinds of people we want to be, and we don't use those institutions to shape other people in our own image. So that would be my take on it.
Yeah, it's actually a wonderful summary of the three different viewpoints that we had on that podcast, and we will point people back to that one. And so a nice summary of that. Finally, the last thing I want to ask here is that your book is in the third edition, and you have been with this thing for over 20 years now. The first edition came out 20 years ago, but you start writing it, and it's with you for a few years before it actually gets published. What have you learned over the course of writing the book, and have you changed your opinion or your ideas about the world based upon the subsequent editions?
I would say that one thing I've learned is that history really matters, that there are historically contingent variables that explain why and how states adopt a particular model, but as I said earlier, those models endure over time. And I think that if you'd have asked me 20 years ago, I would have argued that political democracies are going to converge their public policies over time. So you could look at any number of series of issues, whether it's welfare policy or human rights or church-state relations. And I think I would have said, we're all moving in the same direction. And to some extent, I think there's some truth to that, but I think I'm more convinced than I was then that differences, important differences, will remain. And a lot of that has to do with, again, the degree to which the historical establishment of these different models shapes the different cultures and countries in unique ways. And then I guess I'd say the other thing that I've become more aware of is just the degree to which religious pluralism challenges each of the models, although in different ways. And I guess I'm also more convinced, just because of demographic changes on the ground, that pluralism, religious pluralism, is a fact of life for us. And I've also become more convinced it should be an objective for us, that there are, that it is a challenge, but it also can be an opportunity to promote very robust forms of religious freedom.
Some very, very cool insights from a very long and distinguished career in studying these things. I guess the last question, you're in your third edition. Any plans for a fourth, or do you plan to perhaps shop this around in Hollywood since you're down there in Los Angeles? Maybe get
well,
Chris
I am in Malibu, so everybody's a producer here. I don't know what the kind of market there would be. We'd have to figure out some sort of high-action drama or something.
Yeah, you could do Guardians of the Galaxy number 3, The Challenge of Religious Pluralism or something. That'd be cool.
Well, what I will say is that I'm sure you've had this happen to you too, that you're doing the finishing touches on your book and then facts on the ground change. So I was just thinking today that we were putting the finishing touches on the third edition and England had its Brexit vote. We sent the page proofs off and nationalist parties in France, the Netherlands, and Germany rose to prominence, and Donald Trump was elected president of the United States. So each of those events challenged church-state practices in each of the countries and also pose a threat to religious liberty. So I think there will be plenty of changes that will justify a fourth edition if our publisher is willing to let us go through that process.
Well, that's a good way. Keep the scholarship going, waiting for changes to always occur. I like to bound my studies historically so nobody can say I was wrong on anything. But no, that's another way of keeping things alive. And we definitely will be looking forward to what happens in all these nations, the scholarship that you're doing as well as Kevin is doing as well. And I just want to thank my guest today. It has been Chris Soper. And Chris, thanks for being on Research on Religion.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you for listening to Research on Religion. To learn more about today's topic, participate in a discussion about what you've heard, or browse other podcasts, please visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org. And if you like what we're doing, please tell a friend. We'd appreciate the company. See you next week.